was you I talked to out there on the ice," he stated, astounded, acknowledging that he must have been mistaken when he saw me crossing the flats of the South Call just before dark. "And that was me you talked to. Which means it wasn't Andy Harris at all. Wow. Dude, I'd say you've got some explaining to do." I was stunned. For 2 months I'd been telling people that Harris had walked off the edge of the South Call to his death, when he hadn't done that at all. My error had greatly and unnecessarily compounded the pain of Fiona McPherson, Andy's parents, Ron and Mary Harris, his brother, David Harris, and his many friends. Andy was a large man, over 6 feet tall and 200 pounds, who spoke with a sharp Kiwi lilt. Martin was at least 6 inches shorter, weighed maybe 130 pounds, and spoke in a thick Texas drawl. How had I made such an egregious mistake? Was I really so debilitated that I had stared into the face of a near stranger and mistaken him for a friend with whom I'd spent the previous 6 weeks? And if Andy had never arrived at Camp 4 after reaching the summit, what in the name of God had happened to him? Chapter 17. Summit. 3:40 p.m., May 10th, 1996. 29,028 feet. Our wreck is certainly due to this sudden advent of severe weather, which does not seem to have any satisfactory cause. I do not think human beings ever came through such a month as we have come through, and we should have got through in spite of the weather but for the sickening of a second companion, Captain Oates, and a shortage of fuel in our depots for which I cannot account, and finally, but for the storm which has fallen on us within 11 miles of the depot at which we hoped to secure our final supplies. Surely misfortune could scarcely have exceeded this last blow. We took risks. We knew we took them. Things have come out against us, and therefore we have no cause for complaint, but bow to the will of Providence, determined still to do our best to the last. Had we lived, I should have had a tale to tell of the hardihood, endurance, and courage of my companions, which would have stirred the heart of every Englishman. These rough notes and our dead bodies must tell the tale. Robert Falcon Scott, in Message to the Public, penned just prior to his death in Antarctica on March 29, 1912, from Scott's Last Expedition. Scott Fisher ascended to the summit around 3:40 on the afternoon of May 10th to find his devoted friend and Sirdar, Lobsang Jangbu, waiting for him. The Sherpa pulled his radio from inside his down jacket, made contact with Ingrid Hunt at base camp, then handed the walkie-talkie to Fisher. "We all made it," Fisher told Hunt, 11,400 feet below. "God, I'm tired." A few minutes later, Makalu Gao arrived with 2 Sherpas. Rob Hall was there, too, waiting impatiently for Doug Hansen to appear as a rising tide of cloud lapped ominously at the summit ridge. According to Lobsang, during the 15 or 20 minutes Fisher spent on the summit, he complained repeatedly that he wasn't feeling well, something the congenitally stoic guide almost never did. "Scott tell to me, 'I am too tired. I am sick. Also, need medicine for stomach,'" the Sherpa recalls. "I gave him tea, but he drank just a little bit, just half cup. So I tell to him, 'Scott, please, we go fast down.' So we come down then." Fisher started down first, about 3:55. Lobsang reports that although Scott had used supplemental oxygen during the entire ascent and his third canister was more than 3/4 full when he left the summit, for some reason he took his mask off and stopped using it. Shortly after Fisher left the top, Gao and his Sherpas departed as well, and finally Lobsang headed down, leaving Hall alone on the summit awaiting Hansen. A moment after Lobsang started down, about 4 o'clock, Hansen at last appeared, toughing it out, moving painfully, slowly over the last bump on the ridge. As soon as he saw Hansen, Hall hurried down to meet him. Hall's obligatory turnaround time had come and gone a full 2 hours earlier. Given the guide's conservative, exceedingly methodical nature, Many of his colleagues have expressed puzzlement at this uncharacteristic lapse of judgment. Why, they wondered, didn't he turn Hansen around much lower on the mountain as soon as it became obvious that the American climber was running late? Exactly 1 year earlier, Hall had turned Hansen around on the south summit at 2:30 p.m., and to be denied so close to the top was a crushing disappointment to Hansen. He told me several times that he'd returned to Everest in 1996, largely as a result of Hall's advocacy. He said Rob had called him from New Zealand a dozen times, urging him to give it another shot. And this time, Doug was absolutely determined to bag the top. "I want to get this thing done and out of my life," he told me 3 days earlier at Camp 2. "I don't want to have to come back here. I'm getting too old for this shit." It doesn't seem far-fetched to speculate that because Hall had talked Hansen into coming back to Everest, it would have been especially hard for him to deny Hansen the summit a second time. "It's very difficult to turn someone around high on the mountain," cautions Guy Cotter, a New Zealand guide who summited Everest with Hall in 1992 and was guiding the peak for him in 1995 when Hansen made his first attempt. "If a client sees that the summit is close and they're dead set on getting there, they're going to laugh in your face and keep going up." As the veteran American guide Pete Lev told Climbing Magazine after the disastrous events on Everest, "We think that people pay us to make good decisions, but what people really pay for is to get to the top." In any case, Hall did not turn Hansen around at 2 p.m., or for that matter, at 4, when he met his client just below the top. Instead, according to Lopsang, Hall placed Hansen's arm around his neck and assisted the weary climber up the final 40 feet to the summit. They stayed only a minute or two, then turned to begin the long descent. When Lopsang saw that Hansen was faltering, he held up his own descent long enough to make sure Doug and Rob made it safely across a dangerously corniced area just below the top. Then, eager to catch Fisher, who was by now more than 30 minutes ahead of him, the Sherpa continued down the ridge, leaving Hansen and Hall at the top of the Hillary Step. Just after Lopsang disappeared down the step, Hansen apparently ran out of oxygen and foundered. He'd expended every last bit of his strength to reach the summit, and now there was nothing left in reserve for the descent. "Pretty much the same thing happened to Doug in 95, says Ed Viesters, who, like Cotter, was guiding the peak for Hall that year. "He was fine during the ascent, but as soon as he started down, he lost it mentally and physically. He turned into a zombie, like he'd used everything up." At 4:30 p.m., and again at 4:41, Hall got on the radio to say that he and Hansen were in trouble high on the summit ridge and urgently needed oxygen. 2 full bottles were waiting for them at the south summit. If Hall had known this, he could have retrieved the gas fairly quickly and then climbed back up to give Hansen a fresh tank. But Andy Harris, still at the oxygen cache, in the throes of his hypoxic dementia, overheard these radio calls and broke in to tell Hall, incorrectly, just as he'd told Mike Groom and me, that all the bottles at the South Summit were empty. Groom heard the conversation between Harris and Hall on his radio as he was descending the southeast ridge with Yasko Namba, just above the balcony. He tried to call Hall to correct the misinformation and let him know that there were, in fact, full oxygen canisters waiting for him at the South Summit, but, Groom explains, "my radio was malfunctioning. I was able to receive most calls, but my outgoing calls could rarely be heard by anyone. On the couple of occasions that my calls were being picked up by Rob, and I tried to tell him where the full cylinders were, I was immediately interrupted by Andy, transmitting to say there was no gas at the South Summit." Unsure whether there was oxygen waiting for him, Hall decided that the best course of action was to remain with Hansen and try to bring the nearly helpless client down without gas. But when they got to the top of the Hillary Step, Hall couldn't get Hansen down the 40-foot vertical drop, and their progress ground to a halt. Shortly before 5, Groom finally managed to get through to Hall and communicate that there actually was oxygen at the South Summit. 15 minutes later, Lopsang arrived at the South Summit on his way down from the top and encountered Harris. Note, it wasn't until I interviewed Lobsang in Seattle on July 25, 1996, that I learned he had seen Harris on the evening of May 10th. Although I'd spoken briefly with Lobsang several times previously, I'd never thought to ask whether he'd encountered Harris on the South Summit, because at that point I was still certain I'd seen Harris at the South Col, 3,000 feet below the South Summit, at 6:30 p.m. Moreover, Guy Cotter had asked Lobsang if he'd seen Harris, and for some reason, perhaps a simple misunderstanding of the question, on that occasion, Lobsang said no. End of note. At this point, according to Lobsang, Harris must have finally understood that at least two of the oxygen canisters stashed there were full, because he pleaded with the Sherpa to help him carry the life-sustaining gas up to Hall and Hansen on the Hillary Step. "Andy says he will pay me $500 to bring oxygen to Rob and Doug," Lobsang recalls. "But I am supposed to take care of just my group. I have to take care of Scott. So I say to Andy, no, I go fast down." At 5:30, as Lobsang left the South Summit to resume his descent, he turned to see Harris, who must have been severely debilitated, if his condition when I'd seen him on the South Summit 2 hours earlier was any indication, plodding slowly up the summit ridge to assist Hall and Hansen. It was an act of heroism that would cost Harris his life. A few hundred feet below, Scott Fisher was struggling down the southeast ridge, growing weaker and weaker. Upon reaching the top of the rock steps at 28,400 feet, he was confronted with a series of short but troublesome rappels that angled along the ridge. Too exhausted to cope with the complexities of the rope work, Fisher slid directly down an adjacent snow slope on his butt. This was easier than following the fixed lines, but once he was below the level of the rock steps, it meant that he had to make a laborious 330-foot rising traverse through knee-deep snow to regain the route. Tim Madsen, descending with Beidelman's group, happened to glance up from the balcony around 5:20 and saw Fisher as he began the traverse. "He looked really tired," Madsen remembers. "He'd take 10 steps, then sit and rest, take a couple more steps, rest again. He was moving real slow. But I could see Lobsang above him, coming down the ridge, and I figured, shoot, with Lobsang there to look after him, Scott would be okay." According to Lobsang, the Sherpa caught up with Fisher about 6 p.m., just above the balcony. "Scott is not using oxygen, so I put mask on him. He says, 'I am very sick, too sick to go down. I am going to jump.' He is saying many times, acting like crazy man, so I tie him on rope, quickly. Otherwise, he is jumping down into Tibet." Securing Fisher with a 75-foot length of rope, Lobsang persuaded his friend not to jump, and then got him moving slowly toward the South Col. "The storm is very bad now," Lobsang recalls. "Boom! Boom! 2 times, like sound of gun, there is big thunder. 2 times, lightning hit very close near me and Scott. Very loud, very scared." 300 feet below the balcony, the gentle snow gully they'd been gingerly descending gave way to outcroppings of loose, steep shale, and Fisher was unable to handle the challenging terrain in his ailing condition. "Scott cannot walk now. I have big problem," says Lobsang. "I try to carry, but I am also very tired. Scott is big body. I am very small. I cannot carry him. He tell to me, 'Lobsang, you go down. You go down.' I tell to him, 'No, I stay together here with you.'" About 8 p.m., Lobsang was huddling with Fisher on a snow-covered ledge when Makalu Gao and his 2 Sherpas appeared out of the howling blizzard. Gao was nearly as debilitated as Fisher, and was likewise unable to descend the difficult bands of shale, so his Sherpas sat the Taiwanese climber beside Lobsang and Fisher, and then continued down without him. "I stay with Scott and Makalu 1 hour, maybe longer," says Lobsang. "I am very cold, very tired. Scott tell to me, 'You go down, send up Anatoly.' So I say, 'Okay, I go down. I send quick Sherpa up and Anatoly.' Then I make good place for Scott and go down." Lopsang left Fisher and Gao on a ledge 1,200 feet above the South Col and fought his way down through the storm. Unable to see, he got far off route toward the west, ended up below the level of the Col before he realized his error, and was forced to climb back up the northern margin of the Lhotse face to locate Camp 4. Note: early the next morning, while searching the Col for Andy Harris, I came across Lopsang's faint crampon tracks in the ice leading up from the lip of the Lhotse face, and mistakenly believed they were Harris's tracks, headed down the face, which is why I thought Harris had walked off the edge of the Col. End of note. Around midnight, nevertheless, he made it to safety. "I go to Anatoly tent," reported Lopsang. "I tell to Anatoly, 'Please, you go up. Scott is very sick. He cannot walk.' Then I go to my tent, just fall asleep. Sleep like dead person." Guy Cotter, a longtime friend of both Hall's and Harris's, happened to be a few miles from Everest Base Camp on the afternoon of May 10th, where he was guiding an expedition on Pumori, and had been monitoring Hall's radio transmissions throughout the day. At 2:15 p.m., he talked to Hall on the summit, and everything sounded fine. At 4:30 and 4:41, however, Hall called down to say that Doug was out of oxygen and unable to move, and Cotter became very alarmed. At 4:53, he got on the radio and strongly urged Hall to descend to the south summit. "The call was mostly to convince him to come down and get some gas," says Cotter, "because we knew he wasn't going to be able to do anything for Doug without it. Rob said he could get himself down okay, but not with Doug." But 40 minutes later, Hall was still with Hansen atop the Hillary Step, going nowhere. During radio calls from Hall at 5:36 and again at 5:57, Cotter implored his mate to leave Hansen and come down alone. "I know I sound like the bastard for telling Rob to abandon his client," confessed Cotter, "but by then it was obvious that leaving Doug was his only choice." Hall, however, wouldn't consider going down without Hansen. There was no further word from Hall until the middle of the night. At 2:46 a.m., Cotter woke up in his tent below Pumori to hear a long, broken transmission, probably unintended. Hall had been wearing a remote microphone clipped to the shoulder strap of his backpack, which was occasionally keyed on by mistake. "In this instance," says Cotter, "I suspect Rob didn't even know he was transmitting. I could hear someone yelling. It might have been Rob, but I couldn't be sure because the wind was so loud in the background. But he was saying something like, 'Keep moving! Keep going!' presumably to Doug, urging him on." If this was indeed the case, it meant that in the wee hours of the morning, Hall and Hansen, perhaps accompanied by Harris, were still struggling from the Hillary Step toward the south summit through the gale. And if so, it also meant that it had taken them more than 10 hours to move down a stretch of ridge that was typically covered by descending climbers in less than half an hour. Of course, this is highly speculative. All that is certain is that Hall called down at 5:57 p.m. At that point, he and Hansen were still on the step, and at 4:43 on the morning of May 11th, when he next spoke to base camp, he had descended to the south summit, and at that point, neither Hansen nor Harris was with him. In a series of transmissions over the next 2 hours, Rob sounded disturbingly confused and irrational. During the call at 4:43 a.m., he told Caroline McKenzie, our base camp doctor, that his legs no longer worked, and that he was too clumsy to move. In a ragged, barely audible voice, Rob croaked, "Harold was with me last night, but he doesn't seem to be with me now. He was very weak." Then, obviously befuddled, he asked, "Was Harold with me? Can you tell me that?" Note: I'd already reported with absolute certainty that I'd seen Harris on the South Col at 6:30 p.m., May 10th. When Hall said that Harris was with him up on the South Summit, 3,000 feet higher than where I said I'd seen him, most people, thanks to my error, wrongly assumed that Hall's statements were merely the incoherent ramblings of an exhausted, severely hypoxic man. End of note. By this point, Hall had possession of 2 full oxygen canisters, but the valves on his mask were so choked with ice that he couldn't get the gas to flow. He indicated, however, that he was attempting to de-ice the oxygen rig, which, says Carter, made us all feel a little better. It was the first positive thing we'd heard. At 5 a.m., base camp patched through a call on the satellite telephone to Jan Arnold, Hall's wife, in Christchurch, New Zealand. She had climbed to the summit of Everest with Hall in 1993, and she entertained no illusions about the gravity of her husband's predicament. "My heart really sank when I heard his voice," she recalls. "He was slurring his words markedly. He sounded like Major Tom or something, like he was just floating away. I'd been up there. I knew what it could be like in bad weather. Rob and I had talked about the impossibility of being rescued from the summit ridge. As he himself had put it, you might as well be on the moon." At 5:31, Hall took 4 milligrams of oral dexamethasone and indicated he was still trying to clear his oxygen mask of ice. Talking to base camp, he asked repeatedly about the condition of Makalu Gao, Fisher, Beck Weathers, Yasko Namba, and his other clients. He seemed most concerned about Andy Harris and kept inquiring about his whereabouts. Carter says they tried to steer the discussion away from Harris, who, in all likelihood, was dead, because we didn't want Rob to have another reason for staying up there. At one point, Ed Vistas jumped on the radio from Camp 2 and fibbed, "Don't worry about Andy. He's down here with us." A little later, Mackenzie asked Rob how Hansen was doing. "Doug," Hall replied, "is gone." That was all he said, and it was the last mention he ever made of Hansen. On May 23rd, when David Brashears and Ed Vistas reached the summit, they would find no sign of Hansen's body. They did, however, find an ice axe planted about 50 vertical feet above the south summit, along a very exposed section of ridge where the fixed ropes came to an end. It's quite possible that Hall and or Harris managed to get Hansen down the ropes to this point, only to have him lose his footing and fall 7,000 feet down the sheer southwest face, leaving his ice axe jammed into the ridge where he slipped. But this, too, is merely conjecture. What might have happened to Harris remains even harder to discern. Between Lopsang's testimony, Hall's radio calls, and the fact that another ice axe found on the south summit was positively identified as Andy's, we can be reasonably sure he was at the south summit with Hall on the night of May 10th. Beyond that, however, virtually nothing is known about how the young guide met his end. At 6 a.m., Carter asked Hall if the sun had reached him yet. "Almost," Rob replied, which was good, because he'd mentioned a moment earlier that he was shaking uncontrollably in the awful cold. In conjunction with his earlier revelation that he was no longer able to walk, this had been very upsetting news to the people listening down below. Nevertheless, it was remarkable that Hall was even alive after spending a night without shelter or oxygen at 28,700 feet in hurricane-force winds and wind chill of 100 degrees below zero. During this same radio call, Hall asked after Harris yet again. "Did anyone see Harold last night, except myself?" Some 3 hours later, Rob was still obsessing over Andy's whereabouts. At 8:43 a.m., he mused over the radio, "Some of Andy's gear is still here. I thought he must have gone ahead in the nighttime. Listen, can you account for him or not?" Wilton attempted to dodge the question, but Rob persisted in his line of inquiry. "Okay, I mean his ice axe is here, and his jacket and things." "Rob," Vistas replied from Camp 2, "if you can put the jacket on, just use it. Keep going down and worry only about yourself. Everybody else is taking care of other people. Just get yourself down." After struggling for 4 hours to de-ice his mask, Hall finally got it to work, and by 9 a.m. he was breathing supplemental oxygen for the first time. By then, he'd spent more than 16 hours above 28,700 feet without gas. Thousands of feet below, his friends stepped up their efforts to cajole him to start down. "Rob, this is Helen at base camp," Wilton importuned, sounding as if she was on the brink of tears. You think about that little baby of yours. You're going to see its face in a couple of months, so keep on going. Several times Hall announced he was preparing to descend, and at one point we were sure he'd finally left the south summit. At Camp 4, Lakpa Chiri and I shivered in the wind outside the tents, peering up at a tiny speck moving slowly down the upper southeast ridge. Convinced that it was Rob coming down at last, Lakpa and I slapped each other on the back and cheered him on. But an hour later, my optimism was rudely extinguished when I noticed that the speck was still in the same place. It was actually nothing but a rock, just another altitude-induced hallucination. In truth, Rob had never even left the south summit. Around 9:30 a.m., Ang Dorje and Lakpa Chiri left Camp 4 and started climbing toward the south summit with a thermos of hot tea and two extra canisters of oxygen, intending to rescue Hall. They faced an exceedingly formidable task. As astounding and courageous as Bukharev's rescue of Sandy Pittman and Charlotte Fox had been the night before, it paled in comparison to what the two Sherpas were proposing to do now. Pittman and Fox had been a 20-minute walk from the tents over relatively flat ground. Hall was 3,000 vertical feet above Camp 4, an exhausting 8 or 9 hour climb in the best of circumstances. And these were surely not the best of circumstances. The wind was blowing in excess of 40 knots. Both Ang Dorje and Lakpa were cold and wasted from climbing to the summit and back just the day before. If they did somehow manage to reach Hall, moreover, it would be late afternoon before they got there, leaving only 1 or 2 hours of daylight in which to begin the even more difficult ordeal of bringing him down. Yet their loyalty to Hall was such that the two men ignored the overwhelming odds and set out toward the south summit as fast as they could climb. Shortly thereafter, two Sherpas from the Mountain Madness team, Tashi Chering and Nawang Syakya, a small, trim man graying at the temples, who was Lapsang's father, and one Sherpa from the Taiwanese team headed up to bring down Scott Fisher and Makalu Gao. 1,200 feet above the south call, the trio of Sherpas found the incapacitated climbers on the ledge where Lopsang had left them. Although they tried to give Fisher oxygen, he was unresponsive. Scott was still breathing, barely, but his eyes were fixed in their sockets, and his teeth were tightly clenched. Concluding that he was beyond hope, they left him on the ledge and started descending with Gao, who, after receiving hot tea and oxygen, and with considerable assistance from the three Sherpas, was able to move down to the tents on a short rope under his own power. The day had started out sunny and clear, but the wind remained fierce, and by late morning the upper mountain was wrapped in thick clouds. Down at Camp 2, the IMAX team reported that the wind over the summit sounded like a squadron of 747s, even from 7,000 feet below. Meanwhile, high on the southeast ridge, Ang Dorje and Lakpa Chiri pressed on resolutely through the intensifying storm toward Hall. At 3 p.m., however, still 700 feet below the south summit, the wind and sub-zero cold proved to be too much for them, and the Sherpas could go no higher. It was a valiant effort, but it had failed. And as they turned around to descend, Hall's chances for survival all but vanished. Throughout the day on May 11th, his friends and teammates incessantly begged him to make an effort to come down under his own power. Several times Hall announced that he was preparing to descend, only to change his mind and remain immobile at the south summit. At 3:20 p.m., Cotter, who by now had walked over from his own camp beneath Pumori to the Everest base camp, scolded over the radio, "Rob, get moving down the ridge!" Sounding annoyed, Hall fired back, "Look, if I thought I could manage the knots on the fixed ropes with me frost-bitten hands, I would have gone down 6 hours ago, pal. Just send a couple of the boys up with a big thermos of something hot, then I'll be fine." "Thing is, mate, the lads who went up today encountered some high winds and had to turn around," Cotter replied, trying to convey as delicately as possible that the rescue attempt had been abandoned. "So we think your best shot is to move lower."
I can last another night here if you send up a couple of boys with some Sherpa tea, first thing in the morning, no later than 9:30 or 10, Rob answered.
You're a tough man, big guy, said Cotter, his voice quavering. We'll send some boys up to you in the morning. At 6:20 p.m., Cotter contacted Hall to tell him that Jan Arnold was on the satellite phone from Christchurch and was waiting to be patched through.
Give me a minute, Rob said. Me mouth's dry. I want to eat a bit of snow before I talk to her.
A little later, he came back on and rasped in a slow, horribly distorted voice,
Hi, my sweetheart. I hope you're tucked up in a nice warm bed. How are you doing?
I can't tell you how much I'm thinking about you, Arnold replied. You sound so much better than I expected. Are you warm, my darling?
In the context of the altitude, the setting, I'm reasonably comfortable,
Hall answered, doing his best not to alarm her. How are your feet?
I haven't taken me boots off to check, but I think I may have a bit of frostbite.
I'm looking forward to making you completely better when you come home, said Arnold. I just know you're going to be rescued. Don't feel that you're alone. I'm sending all my positive energy your way. Before signing off, Hall told his wife,
I love you. Sleep well, my sweetheart. Please don't worry too much.
These would be the last words anyone would hear him speak. Attempts to make radio contact with Hall later that night and the next day went unanswered. 12 days later, when Brashears and Vesters climbed over the south summit on their way to the top, they found Hall lying on his right side in a shallow ice hollow, his upper body buried beneath a drift of snow. Chapter 18. Northeast Ridge, May 10, 1996. 28,550 feet. Everest was the embodiment of the physical forces of the world. Against it, he had to pit the spirit of man. He could see the joy in the faces of his comrades if he succeeded. He could imagine the thrill his success would cause among all fellow mountaineers, the credit it would bring to England, the interest all over the world, the name it would bring him, the enduring satisfaction to himself that he had made his life worthwhile. Perhaps he never exactly formulated it, yet in his mind must have been present the idea of all or nothing. Of the two alternatives, to turn back a third time or to die, the latter was for Mallory probably the easier. The agony of the first would be more than he as a man, as a mountaineer, and as an artist could endure. Sir Francis Younghusband, The Epic of Mount Everest, 1926. At 4 p.m. on May 10th, around the same time a hurting Doug Hansen arrived on the summit, supported by Rob Hall's shoulder, three climbers from the northern Indian province of Ladakh radioed down to their expedition leader that they, too, were on top of Everest. Members of a 39-person expedition organized by the Indo-Tibetan Border Police, Tsewang Smanla, Tsewang Paljor, and Dorji Morup, had ascended from the Tibetan side of the peak via the Northeast Ridge route, the route on which George Lee Mallory and Andrew Irvin had so famously disappeared in 1924. Leaving their high camp at 27,230 feet as a party of six, the Ladakhis did not get away from their tents until 5:45 a.m. Note. To avoid confusion, all times quoted in this chapter have been converted to Nepal time, even though the events I describe occurred in Tibet. Clocks in Tibet are set to reflect the Beijing time zone, which is 2 hours and 15 minutes ahead of the Nepal time zone, e.g., 6 a.m. in Nepal is 8:15 in Tibet. End of note. By mid-afternoon, still more than 1,000 vertical feet below the top, they were engulfed by the same storm clouds that we encountered on the other side of the mountain. Three members of the team threw in the towel and went down at around 2 p.m., but Smanla, Paljor, and Morup pushed onward despite the deteriorating weather. They were overcome by summit fever, explained Harbhajan Singh, one of the three who turned around. The other three reached what they believed to be the summit at 4 p.m., by which time the clouds had become so thick that visibility was reduced to no more than 100 feet. They radioed their base camp on the Rongbuk Glacier to say they were on top, whereupon the leader of the expedition, Mohinder Singh, placed a satellite telephone call to New Delhi and proudly reported the triumph to Prime Minister Narasimha Rao. Celebrating their success, the summit team left an offering of prayer flags, katas, and climbing pitons on what appeared to be the highest point, and then descended into the fast-rising blizzard. In truth, the Ladakhis were at 28,550 feet when they turned around, about 2 hours below the actual summit, which at that time still jutted above the highest clouds. The fact that they unwittingly stopped some 500 feet short of their goal explains why they didn't see Hansen, Hall, or Lopsang on top, and vice versa. Later, shortly after dark, climbers lower on the northeast ridge reported seeing two headlamps in the vicinity of 28,300 feet, just above a notoriously problematic cliff known as the Second Step. But none of the three Ladakhis made it back to their tents that night, nor did they make further radio contact. At 1:45 the next morning, May 11th, around the same time Anatoly Bukharev was frantically searching the South Col for Sandy Pittman, Charlotte Fox, and Tim Madsen, two Japanese climbers, accompanied by three Sherpas, set out for the summit from the same high camp on the northeast ridge that the Ladakhis had used, despite the very high winds buffeting the peak. At 6 a.m., as they skirted a steep rock promontory called the First Step, 21-year-old Eisuke Shigekawa and 36-year-old Hiroshi Hanada were taken aback to see one of the Ladakhi climbers, probably Paljor, lying in the snow, horribly frostbitten, but still alive after a night without shelter or oxygen, moaning unintelligibly. Not wanting to jeopardize their ascent by stopping to assist him, the Japanese team continued climbing toward the summit. At 7:15 a.m., they arrived at the base of the Second Step, a dead vertical prow of crumbling schist that is usually ascended by means of an aluminum ladder that had been lashed to the cliff by a Chinese team in 1975. To the dismay of the Japanese climbers, however, the ladder was falling apart and had become partially detached from the rock, so 90 minutes of strenuous climbing were required to surmount this 20-foot cliff. Just beyond the top of the Second Step, they came upon the other two Ladakhis, Smanla and Morop. According to an article in the Financial Times, written by the British journalist Richard Cowper, who interviewed Hanada and Shigekawa at 21,000 feet immediately after their ascent, one of the Ladakhis was apparently close to death, the other crouching in the snow. No words were passed, no water, food, or oxygen exchanged hands. The Japanese moved on, and 160 feet farther along, they rested and changed oxygen cylinders. Hanada told Cowper, "We didn't know them. No, we didn't give them any water. We didn't talk to them. They had severe high-altitude sickness. They looked as if they were dangerous." Shigekawa explained, "We were too tired to help. Above 8,000 meters is not a place where people can afford morality." Turning their backs on Smanla and Morup, the Japanese team resumed their ascent, past the prayer flags and pitons left by the Ladakhis at 28,550 feet, and, in an astonishing display of tenacity, reached the summit at 11:45 a.m. in a screaming gale. Rob Hall was at that moment huddled on the south summit, fighting for his life, a half-hour's climb below them along the southeast ridge. During their return down the northeast ridge to their high camp, the Japanese again came across Smanla and Morup above the Second Step. At this time, Morup appeared to be dead. Smanla, though still alive, was hopelessly tangled in a fixed line. Pasang Kami, a Sherpa on the Japanese team, freed Smanla from the rope, then continued down the ridge. As they descended past the first step, where on the way up they had climbed past Paljor, crumpled and raving in the snow, the Japanese party now saw no sign of the third Ladaki. 7 days later, the Indo-Tibetan Border Police expedition launched another summit attempt. Departing their high camp at 1:15 on the morning of May 17th, two Ladakis and three Sherpas soon came upon the frozen bodies of their teammates. They reported that one of the men, in his death throes, had torn off most of his clothing before finally succumbing to the elements. Smanla, Morup, and Paljor were left on the mountain where they had fallen, and the five climbers continued to the top of Everest, which they reached at 7:40 a.m. Chapter 19. South Call, 7:30 a.m., May 11th, 1996. 26,000 feet. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere, the ceremony of innocence is drowned. William Butler Yeats, The Second Coming. When I wobbled back to Camp 4 around 7:30 Saturday morning, May 11th, the actuality of what had happened, of what was still happening, began to sink in with paralyzing force. I was physically and emotionally wrecked after having just spent an hour scouring the South Call for Andy Harris. The search had left me convinced that he was dead. Radio calls my teammate Stuart Hutchison had been monitoring from Rob Hall on the South Summit made clear that our leader was in desperate straits and that Doug Hansen was dead. Members of Scott Fisher's team, who'd spent most of the night lost on the call, reported that Yasko Namba and Beck Weathers were dead. And Scott Fisher and Makalu Gao were believed to be dead, or very near death, 1,200 feet above the tents. Confronted with this tally, my mind balked and retreated into a weird, almost robotic state of detachment. I felt emotionally anesthetized, yet hyper-aware, as if I had fled into a bunker deep inside my skull and was peering out at the wreckage around me through a narrow, armored slit. As I gazed numbly at the sky, it seemed to have turned a preternaturally pale shade of blue, bleached of all but the faintest remnant of color. The jagged horizon was limned with a corona-like glow that flickered and pulsed before my eyes. I wondered if I had begun the downward spiral into the nightmarish territory of the mad. After a night at 26,000 feet without supplemental oxygen, I was even weaker and more exhausted than I had been the previous evening after coming down from the summit. Unless we somehow acquired some more gas or descended to a lower camp, I knew that my teammates and I would continue to deteriorate rapidly. The fast-track acclimatization schedule followed by Hall and most other modern Everesters is remarkably efficient. It allows climbers to embark for the summit after spending a relatively brief 4-week period above 17,000 feet, including just a single overnight acclimatization excursion to 24,000 feet. Note: in 1996, Rob Hall's team spent just 8 nights at Camp 2, 21,300 feet or higher, before setting out for the summit from base camp, which is a pretty typical acclimatization period nowadays. Prior to 1990, climbers commonly spent considerably more time at Camp 2 or higher, including at least one acclimatization sortie to 26,000 feet before embarking for the top. Although the value of acclimatizing as high as 26,000 feet is debatable, the deleterious effects of spending extra time at such extreme altitude may well offset the benefits, there is little question that extending the current 8 or 9 night acclimatization period at 21,000 to 24,000 feet would provide a greater margin of safety. End of note. Yet this strategy is predicated on the assumption that everyone will have a continuous supply of bottled oxygen above 24,000 feet. When that ceases to be the case, all bets are off. Searching out the rest of our crew, I found Frank Fishbeck and Lou Kosicki lying in a nearby tent. Lou was delirious and snowblind, completely without sight, unable to do anything for himself, muttering incoherently. Frank looked as if he were in a severe state of shock, but he was doing his best to take care of Lou. John Taskey was in another tent with Mike Groom. Both men appeared to be asleep or unconscious. As rickety and feeble as I felt, it was obvious that everyone else except Stuart Hutchison was faring even worse. As I went from tent to tent, I tried to locate some oxygen, but all the canisters I found were empty. The ongoing hypoxia, coupled with my profound fatigue, exacerbated the sense of chaos and despair. Thanks to the relentless din of nylon flapping in the wind, it was impossible to communicate from tent to tent. The batteries in our one remaining radio were nearly depleted. An atmosphere of terminal entropy pervaded the camp, heightened by the fact that our team, which for the preceding 6 weeks had been encouraged to rely thoroughly on our guides, was now suddenly and utterly without leadership. Rob and Andy were gone, and although Groom was present, the ordeal of the previous night had taken a terrible toll on him. Seriously frostbitten, lying insensate in his tent, at least for the time being, he was unable even to speak. With all our guides hors de combat, Hutchison stepped up to fill the leadership vacuum. A high-strung, self-serious young man from the upper crust of English-speaking Montreal society, he was a brilliant medical researcher who went on a big mountaineering expedition every 2 or 3 years, but otherwise had little time for climbing. As the crisis mounted at Camp 4, he did his best to rise to the occasion. While I tried to recover from my fruitless search for Harris, Hutchison organized a team of 4 Sherpas to locate the bodies of Weathers and Namba, who had been left on the far side of the call when Anatoly Bukharev brought in Charlotte Fox, Sandy Pittman, and Tim Madsen. The Sherpa search party, headed by Lok Bachiri, departed ahead of Hutchison, who was so exhausted and befuddled that he'd forgotten to put his boots on and had tried to leave camp in his light, smooth-soled liners. Only when Lakpa pointed out the blunder did Hutchison return for his boots. Following Bukharev's directions, the Sherpas quickly found the 2 bodies on a slope of gray ice freckled with boulders near the lip of the Kangshung face. Extremely superstitious about the dead, as many Sherpas are, they halted 60 or 70 feet away and waited for Hutchison. Both bodies were partially buried, Hutchison recalls. Their backpacks were maybe 100 feet away, uphill from them. Their faces and torsos were covered with snow. Only their hands and feet were sticking out. The wind was just screaming across the call. The first body he came to turned out to be Namba, but Hutchison couldn't discern who it was until he knelt in the gale and chipped a 3-inch-thick carapace of ice from her face. Stunned, he discovered that she was still breathing. Both her gloves were gone, and her bare hands appeared to be frozen solid. Her eyes were dilated. The skin on her face was the color of white porcelain. It was terrible, Hutchison recalls. I was overwhelmed. She was very near death. I didn't know what to do. He turned his attention to Beck, who lay 20 feet away. Beck's head was also caked with a thick armor of frost. Balls of ice the size of grapes were matted to his hair and eyelids. After clearing the frozen detritus from Beck's face, Hutchison discovered that the Texan was still alive, too. Beck was mumbling something, I think, but I couldn't tell what he was trying to say. His right glove was missing, and he had terrible frostbite. I tried to get him to sit up, but he couldn't. He was as close to death as a person can be, and still be breathing. Horribly shaken, Hutchison went over to the Sherpas and asked Lakpa's advice. Lakpa, an Everest veteran respected by Sherpas and Sahibs alike for his mountain savvy, urged Hutchison to leave Beck and Yasko where they lay. Even if they survived long enough to be dragged back to Camp 4, they would certainly die before they could be carried down to base camp, and attempting a rescue would needlessly jeopardize the lives of the other climbers on the call, most of whom were going to have enough trouble getting themselves down safely. Hutchison decided that Lakpa was right. There was only one choice, however difficult. Let nature take its inevitable course with Beck and Yasko, and save the group's resources for those who could actually be helped. It was a classic act of triage. When Hutchison returned to camp, he was on the verge of tears and looked like a ghost. At his urging, we roused Tasky and Groom and then crowded into their tent to discuss what to do about Beck and Yasko. The conversation that ensued was anguished and halting. We avoided making eye contact. After 5 minutes, however, all four of us concurred. Hutchison's decision to leave Beck and Yasko where they lay was the proper course of action. We also debated heading down to Camp 2 that afternoon, but Tasky was insistent that we not descend from the call while Hall was marooned on the south summit. "I won't even consider leaving without him," he pronounced. It was a moot point regardless. Kosciuszko and Groom were in such bad shape that going anywhere was out of the question for the time being. By then, I was very worried that we were headed for a repeat of what happened on K2 in 1986, says Hutchison. On July 4th of that year, 7 Himalayan veterans, including the legendary Austrian Bergsteiger Kurt Diemberger, set out for the summit of the world's second highest mountain. 6 of the 7 reached the top, but during the descent, a severe storm struck the upper slopes of K2, pinning the climbers in their high camp at 26,250 feet. As the blizzard continued without let-up for 5 days, they grew weaker and weaker. When the storm finally broke, only Diemberger and one other person made it down alive. Saturday morning, as we discussed what to do about Namba and Weathers and whether to descend, Neil Beidelman was mustering Fisher's team from their tents and hectoring them to start down from the call. "Everyone was so messed up from the night before that it was really hard getting our group up and out of the tents. I practically had to punch some people to get them to put their boots on," he says. "But I was adamant that we leave immediately. In my view, staying at 26,000 feet longer than absolutely necessary is asking for trouble. I could see that rescue efforts were underway for Scott and Rob, so I turned my full attention to getting our clients off the call and down to a lower camp." While Bukharev remained behind at Camp 4 to wait for Fisher, Beidelman herded his group slowly down from the call. At 25,000 feet, he paused to give Pittman another injection of dexamethasone, and then everyone stopped for a long time at Camp 3 to rest and rehydrate. "When I saw those guys," said David Brashears, who was at Camp 3 when Beidelman's crew arrived, "I was astounded. They looked like they'd been through a 5-month war. Sandy started to break down. She was crying. 'It was terrible. I just gave up and lay down to die.'" All of them appeared to be in severe shock. Just before dark, the last of Beidelman's group was working their way down the steep ice of the lower Lhotse face, when 500 feet from the bottom of the fixed ropes, they were met by some Sherpas from a Nepali cleanup expedition who'd come up to assist them. As they resumed their descent, a volley of grapefruit-sized stones came whizzing down from the upper mountain, and one of them struck a Sherpa in the back of the head. "The rock just creamed him," says Beidelman, who observed the incident from a short distance above. "It was sickening," Clev Schoening recalls. "It sounded like he'd been hit with a baseball bat." The force of the blow chipped a divot as large as a silver dollar from the Sherpa's skull, knocked him unconscious, and sent him into cardiopulmonary arrest. As he flopped over and started sliding down the rope, Schoening jumped in front of him and managed to halt his fall. But a moment later, as Schoening cradled the Sherpa in his arms, a second rock came down and smashed into the Sherpa. Once again, the man took the impact squarely on the back of his head. Despite the second blow, after a few minutes, the stricken man gasped violently and began breathing again. Beidelman managed to lower him to the bottom of the Lhotse face, where a dozen of the Sherpa's teammates met them and carried the injured man to Camp 2. "At that point," says Beidelman, "Clev and I just stared at each other in disbelief. It was like, what's going on here? What have we done to make this mountain so angry?" Throughout April and early May, Rob Hall had expressed his concern that one or more of the less competent teams might blunder into a bad jam, compelling our group to rescue them, thereby ruining our summit bid. Now, ironically, it was Hall's expedition that was in grave trouble, and other teams were in the position of having to come to our aid. Without rancor, three such groups, Todd Burleson's Alpine Ascents International Expedition, David Brashear's IMAX Expedition, and Mal Duff's Commercial Expedition, immediately postponed their own summit plans in order to assist the stricken climbers. The day before, Friday, May 10th, while we in Hall's and Fisher's teams were climbing from Camp 4 toward the top, the Alpine Ascents International Expedition, headed by Burleson and Pete Athens, was arriving at Camp 3. On Saturday morning, as soon as they learned of the disaster that was unfolding above, Burleson and Athens left their clients at 24,000 feet in care of their third guide, Jim Williams, and rushed up to the South Col to help. Brashear's, Ed Veister's, and the rest of the IMAX team happened to be in Camp 2 at that time. Brashear's immediately suspended filming in order to direct all of his expedition's resources toward the rescue effort. First, he relayed a message to me that some spare batteries were stashed in one of the IMAX tents on the call. By mid-afternoon, I'd found them, allowing Hall's team to reestablish radio contact with the lower camps. Then Brashear's offered his expedition's supply of oxygen, 50 canisters that had been laboriously carried to 26,000 feet, to the ailing climbers and would-be rescuers on the call. Even though this threatened to put his $5.5 million film project in jeopardy, he made the crucial gas available without hesitation. Athens and Burleson arrived at Camp 4 in mid-morning, immediately began distributing IMAX gas bottles to those of us starved for oxygen, then waited to see what came of the Sherpas' efforts to rescue Hall, Fisher, and Gao. At 4:35 p.m., Burleson was standing outside the tents when he noticed someone walking slowly toward camp with a peculiar, stiff-kneed gait. "Hey, Pete," he called to Athens, "check this out. Somebody's coming into camp." The person's bare right hand, naked to the frigid wind and grotesquely frostbitten, was outstretched in a kind of odd, frozen salute. Whoever it was reminded Athens of a mummy in a low-budget horror film. As the mummy lurched into camp, Burleson realized that it was none other than Beck Weathers, somehow risen from the dead. The previous night, huddling with Groom, Beidleman, Namba, and the other members of that group, Weathers had felt himself growing colder and colder. "I'd lost my right glove. My face was freezing. My hands were freezing. I felt myself growing really numb, and then it got really hard to stay focused, and finally I just sort of slid off into oblivion." Through the rest of the night, and most of the following day, Beck lay out on the ice, exposed to the merciless wind, cataleptic and barely alive. He has no recollection of Bukharev coming for Pittman, Fox, and Madsen, nor does he remember Hutchison finding him in the morning and chipping the ice from his face. He remained comatose for more than 12 hours. Then, late Saturday afternoon, for some unknowable reason, a light went on in the reptilian core of Beck's inanimate brain, and he floated back to consciousness. "Initially, I thought I was in a dream," Weathers recalls. "When I first came to, I thought I was laying in bed. I didn't feel cold or uncomfortable. I sort of rolled onto my side, got my eyes open, and there was my right hand staring me in the face. Then I saw how badly frozen it was, and that helped bring me around to reality. Finally, I woke up enough to recognize that I was in deep shit and the cavalry wasn't coming, so I better do something about it myself." Although Beck was blind in his right eye and able to focus his left eye within a radius of only 3 or 4 feet, he started walking directly into the wind, deducing correctly that camp lay in that direction. Had he been mistaken, he would have stumbled immediately down the Kangshung face, the edge of which lay just 30 feet in the opposite direction. About 90 minutes later, he encountered some unnaturally smooth, bluish-looking rocks, which turned out to be the tents of Camp 4. Hutchison and I were in our tent monitoring a radio call from Rob Hall on the South Summit when Burleson came rushing over.
"Doctor, we need you bad,"
he yelled to Stuart from just outside the door.